Well, good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Workforce, Labor and Economic Development, Finance and Policy Committee. I am one of the two co-chairs, along with Representative Baker, of the committee. And my apologies, things started a little bit late. Should have left a little more time. But grateful for those who made it here. And I know we're going to be joined by others as well. We're going to start by taking the minutes. And I know we had a new CLA on both the GOP and DFL side, so well done to our new GOP CLA for putting this together. Chair Baker, are you interested in possibly moving those minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additions or corrections, members, to the minutes from yesterday? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, we have got minutes approved. Members, this is a hearing that I've been looking forward to for really since last session. And originally my thought was to have a discussion about the importance, the impact of immigration on our economy and our workforce. I feel like I've seen, even over the last number of months, increasing focus on that, including there was an op-ed in the Star Tribune, or actually a columnist in the Star Tribune over the weekend talking about that. Since my thought about that, though, we've had this unprecedented federal Operation Metro surge in our state. And we know that there's been a significant economic and workforce impact from that, and that felt worth discussing as well. We'll be considering later in the session, I know we've got a proposal from Governor Walz from the administration regarding some support for those businesses and communities that have been impacted in particular by that. I expect that there'll be other proposals advancing as well. In having both these topics in this hearing, though, I don't want to imply that the impact of Operation Metro Surge has merely been on Minnesotans who are immigrants, in particular undocumented immigrants. We know that there has been a significant impact on Minnesotans with legal status and on U.S. citizens as well, including most tragically the loss of life of two U.S. citizens. I certainly am aware, and I know others as well, and there's been a lot of documented evidence of citizens, people with legal status, experiencing significant violations of their rights, according to the information they provided. We know we had a federal judge who found that ICE had violated more court orders in Minnesota, in the opinion of this judge, a Republican appointee, I might add, than most federal agents have violated in the history of their agency. So there's a lot of issues coming out of the last couple months. The focus today for me, and I would think for this committee, is the impact in terms of our economy and our workforce, as I say, in the short run of the last couple months. But then I also want to make sure we don't lose sight of the broader impact of immigration in terms of our economy and our workforce, which is squarely in the purview of this committee. So that's the purpose today. We've got a series of presenters from some different angles, not at all covering the waterfront. Again, I think this will be something we'll be discussing throughout the session, but I want to at least sort of get the conversation started. That's the purpose of the day. Chair Baker, is there anything that you want to add? Please do, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I also look forward to this hearing today. This has been a hard several months, several weeks for all of us in the state. I personally recognize the importance of our immigration community, of our residents, of our legal status folks, and again, those that are working and doing really important jobs in the state. I have a lot of them in my district as well. So this is important, and there's a lot of things that we need to understand better, and what can we do? We're going to be honest about policies that make it already really hard for businesses that retain people. And there are, you know, a lot of policies keep businesses on the very edge of existence. And then when we have this kind of surge, which is not good, it doesn't help it. And we got to make sure that we do the balance. Again, I mentioned this yesterday, but it's about balance, about getting it right for the employers and the workers. So I look forward to really good conversations. I lost a couple of employees, too, at one of my hotels that had to leave the state for a couple weeks. I supported that. Now they're finally back, and I get it. This was not something that anybody wanted, but we have policies in the state that gave us that bit of that center fusion, if you will, and we need to just work on that. So I'm hoping we can work on this together and do the right thing moving forward so that we don't have anything like this again. So appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I look forward to this.
But I know you've got a presentation. We're going to see if we can get our head of you.
But as we do, Commissioner, please identify yourself. We're so glad to have you for the committee, sir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members. I'm Matt Verlick, Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development in the Cabinet of Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan. And we do indeed have a presentation up, and if it's okay, Mr. Co-Chair, I would just proceed into it.
Yeah, please do. Thank you, Commissioner.
And let me say first that for the initial slides, we have about six or seven slides, and in the initial ones, I'll be, to a certain extent, impersonating the state demographer, who I actually got to hear testify yesterday, and also the head of our labor market information unit, Angelina Nguyen, who helps to produce a lot of the data at DEED. And I would also add, just as sort of a personal note, it struck me as I was talking to her that she is a refugee from Vietnam and a naturalized U.S. citizen and provides enormous value at our agency. And anyone who's ever looked at any unemployment figure in the state of Minnesota can thank Angelina. And then you go on down the line of senior leadership at DEED, and there are many of my colleagues who have chosen to put their talents to work in this state. And so we're proud of that, and that sort of underscores the human side of what we're going to talk about in all these data here. So to go somewhat quickly in a very dense slide, you can see at the top the total number of foreign-born residents that we have in Minnesota as of 2024. It comprises 9% of the state's total population, which is less than the U.S. as a whole at 14.8%, whereas we have 9%. We gained 95,500 from the 10-year period, 2014 to 24. I believe this is all U.S. Census data. That's a 22.3% increase. So even though we have fewer foreign-born residents at present, we are outpacing the nation as a whole. You can see the kind of pace in that chart on the right-hand side, where Minnesota is the green and the United States as a whole is the dark blue. Note that the y-axis, the left-hand side is the U.S. axis and the right-hand side is Minnesota. You can see in 2014 that is the sort of dividing line at which we started to outpace in terms of total foreign-born population in our state. Let's go to the sub-bullet that says for the five-year period from 2020 to 24, international in-migration was a plus 81,000, domestic out-migration minus 48,000. That's something, that's a trend we've talked about with many of you in the past. However, I would also like to point out that the most recent figures for 2025 showed that after 20 years of almost always having negative net domestic migration, we finally turned that around. And we heard our colleagues at Explore Minnesota yesterday talking about the fact that they've had money through Explore Minnesota for Business, telling Minnesota's story and attracting now more people from domestic locations to the state. Hope that can continue. I do have my fears based on all the things that we've been through of late, but that's an interesting trend.
And one moment, Commissioner. Representative Schultz, do you have a quick clarifying question?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, just a quick question just for process this morning. Are we going to be, is it primarily going to be presentations, or are we going to have dialogues throughout? And with the Commissioner and the presentations, are we able to ask questions?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Schultz. My thought, so we've built in a bit of question time after each presentation, so the opportunity for that. If there are clarifying questions, I do like if there's something small you want to ask in the middle, it's fine, like you just did. So, all right, thank you, Representative Schultz. Commissioner, please continue.
Thank you. So you can see also 58.1% of Minnesota foreign-born residents have become naturalized U.S. citizens. That is a higher rate than the U.S. as a whole. The remainder, the 40% or so, would be in some other status, perhaps in process of seeking naturalization or perhaps green card holder, et cetera. And then there is a concentration of our immigrant population in the seven-county metro with 77.6%. That compares to 55.2% of the total population, also higher naturalization rate of the metro immigrant born. But I would also note I come from the St. Cloud area, as many of you know. Representative Schultz, my representative, I think includes that area. Perryman and others, but Wolgamott. Nevertheless, we have a large immigrant population in that area as well that we are proud of. So it does, of course, include greater Minnesota. Here we have economic impact, and this is another demographic slide that features age distribution. So just to orient you on the slide, on the left-hand side, the navy blue is the foreign-born population, and then you can see those are age bands, and the percentage of the foreign-born population that fall into each age band. On the right-hand side, you have the total population. I think maybe rather than just get into all the details of the bullet points, what I'll point out to you is that the foreign-born population has a larger concentration, a larger share of itself is in the working age range. So you look at 35 to 44 years, you see 24.9% of the foreign-born population is in that range. That's the peak of the bell curve there, whereas on the right-hand side, the total population as a whole, and you can imagine it would also be true for the U.S.-born population, that it's flatter there. And so what this tells us is that, again, that population is able to make a large contribution to the economic activity of the state. Next slide. This one shows, let's again start with the graphic. It shows educational attainment and educational requirement of job vacancies. So the top bar, Minnesota job vacancies, shows what kind of educational attainment you need for the jobs that are open. The navy blue being less than a high school graduate, the light green being high school graduate, all the way on up to graduate or professional degree. So you see that only 5% of the vacancies require that graduate degree. If you look at the total population on the bottom, and I know I'm going out of order, but the total population, that shows attainment, only 6% have less than a high school degree, et cetera. Look at the foreign-born population, very even distribution. Members of the foreign-born population are relatively evenly distributed across those bands. And look at the graduate or professional degree attainment. It is in excess of the population as a whole. So, in fact, quite a highly educated group of individuals. And that, again, is important as we hear from so many businesses. And we've been in a period of workforce shortage, of course, where businesses tell us they need more people of all sorts of talents. And the fact that for a long time domestic migration has been negative, the international migration has saved us in some ways and allowed us to continue growing along with natural growth through births in excess of deaths. And you again see that this is a highly talented group of individuals. So that kind of concludes just the data-based items that we wanted to share with you. And now I wanted to transition a little bit into some of what I've been hearing and what our department has been hearing on the impacts of Metro Surge. And as you pointed out, Mr. Co-Chair, notwithstanding the name of the surge, which has Metro in it, we've seen these impacts all across the state. Co-Chair Baker, you mentioned it, and I certainly have seen it in my neck of the woods and beyond. I've seen a lot of reports from Rochester. So it's a lot of fear, and the fear translates into economic harm. The tactics, of course, are what I think have been the focus of what went wrong, what was done improperly. And the fear meant that lots of workers were not comfortable continuing to show up for work. Lots of customers were not comfortable continuing to go out and buy their necessities. You had whole families in hiding. And again, so often it was without respect to their legal status. It was simply color of your skin. And I have lots of anecdotes of people I talked to who were in that boat and in some cases were, pulled over and treated badly, again, without regard to their status. So what that means is we have many businesses who have revenue that's way down. We have many businesses that cannot operate properly because they don't have full staffing, and some have closed entirely. And I've shared the anecdote before that before the governor had announced yet the shop local stand together notion, many of us were already doing that thing that we learned to do during COVID, which is buy the gift cards, go out to eat, and support businesses just by opening your pocketbook where you could. And so Senator Eric Putnam and I from the St. Cloud area decided we were going to go out to dinner one Saturday night, and the first Mexican restaurant we went to was closed, and we think it was for this reason. And so then we had to go to Plan B. And so just an example. And then we have subsequently, maybe you've seen the news coverage, had events at Malcolm Yard in Minneapolis, which, of course, is a fantastic food hall. They offer beer as well, if you're interested. But at a time when they would normally be bustling, it was almost crickets because of these kinds of impacts. So in terms of a response, number one, was very proud to stand at Los Ocampo in St. Paul and announced the governor's proclamation of February as Shop Local Month, and as part of this campaign, Shop Local Stand Together to do what I just mentioned. And I was accompanied that day by the owner of that place, Julian, and also by one of your other testifiers who's behind me right now, R.T. Ryback, who runs the Minneapolis Foundation, who very rapidly set up a business response fund in addition to hosting the Salt Cure Fund focused just on restaurants. But the business response fund that he can talk about was funded largely by some of our largest employers in Minnesota, so a nice example of mutual support, which we appreciate. And then in addition, the governor last Thursday, together with me, announced his recommendation to the legislature for a $10 million package to assist small businesses impacted by Metro Surge. And you can see what the qualifications would be. It would be partially forgivable loans, 3-year term, 0% interest. After 1 year, if you can prove that you've roughly maintained employment, the option to propose or to seek 50% forgivability. And the notion would be that that would help us extend that relatively modest amount of money to more businesses. And we would acknowledge, as the governor has, that that's a small amount relative to the scale of impact, but hopefully it all helps. And that concludes my prepared presentation. Happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Recent data, and I'm not quite sure about the 2025 data because what you presented about domestic migration is new to me. Previously, prior to that data, what I was aware of is that across the last several years, the only migration to Minnesota came from the portion of the economy which occupies the very bottom of the economic scale. Is the 2025 data any different? Because that population, which is the bottom of the economic scale, also takes additional government benefits, welfare benefits, and I'm curious as to the numbers that you referenced for 2025.
Commissioner.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. Also, first, just to mention, I acknowledge your point, Mr. Co-Chair, that not only are the operations continuing, but the fear that translates into the economic harm, that will last even after the last agent has gone. To your point, Representative, first, want to clarify that what I was saying has turned in 2025 is the domestic net migration. Now, the state demographer would point out that I don't know exactly what the absolute numbers are, but that maybe, let's say, 100,000 people move out of Minnesota and maybe 99,000 move in, and so that would be a minus 1,000. And so there are a lot of people going both directions, and it's only a small net change. But what has happened last year is that now it's a net positive. So maybe it's 105,000 moved in and 100,000 moved out. So anyway, it's a good trend. And I also mentioned that international migration has been net positive, and I don't know if that's perhaps where you're thinking about with the question of the economic classification of who is coming here. And my team is sharing some information here that I haven't been able to read yet, but I would say it's a wide range of individuals. And if you look back at that educational attainment slide of who are the foreign-born population, showing that we have more people with PhDs in the foreign-born population that we have in the population as a whole. And so I would think it's fair to surmise from that that it is certainly not confined to lower-income occupations.
And Representative Schultz, I expect we'll have Susan Brower, the state demographer, I'm hoping to have at a future hearing. And she was who we were going to have present on this. She wasn't available today, but so she may be able to answer that. But Representative Schultz, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did submit additional documents that you all have in your email for this committee that will hopefully be a part of the record online in this regard. The reason that I mentioned this, Mr. Chair, and for the committee is not only those trends that say that the only folks that have been actually coming into this state are those folks that are benefiting from additional public programs at a cost to taxpayers. So one document for our purposes that I did submit here is showing what larger increase there is for folks who are at the lower end of that income scale, the cost that they are, especially when they're not native-born Minnesotans or Americans, that there is an immense higher amount of cost to our welfare system than for those who were born here. In addition, I wanted to ask specifically through the lens of Operation Metro Surge, which is what this hearing is about, and the economic impact. I wanted to find out, Commissioner, if you can describe for the committee why the state has done so well economically while Operation Metro Surge has taken place. Every month since the most recent budget forecast for the state has seen surpluses, including in January, so just last month of last year, the state was projected to take in $3 billion. And instead of getting approximately $3 billion, the state in January alone took in $3.5 billion. And so that was in excess of the budget forecast to the tune of $513 million. During January of this year. How do we reckon with those facts and this idea in the media that somehow our state has been negatively impacted when our state budget has seen immense benefit, including and specifically in income taxes paid? That means that Minnesotans are working. That means that our economy is growing, and I really want to hear as to how we are seeing these stories that certainly are completely out of tune with what Minnesota management and budget is delivering to us, the legislature.
Commissioner, to you.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative, thank you for the questions. First of all, again, regarding the notion that only lower-income people are coming, I mean, number one, I think my great-grandparents, when they came here, were super low income, and they have, you know, gone on to have offspring who have, you know, advanced up the income scale, and that's a very common story. And we have lots of needs in the economy for people at all educational attainment levels. One thing that my colleagues did provide me was to share some information on the economic contribution of the individuals we're talking about. So the American Immigration Council estimates that foreign-born immigrants have combined spending power of $17 billion and tax contributions of $6.2 billion, with $2.3 billion in state and local taxes paid, $3.9 billion in federal taxes paid. I think that's Minnesota numbers, but I'm only just seeing this now. So that's one, just regarding overall economic contributions. Two, to your point about overall state economic performance and how that can be true at the same time as the negative impacts of Metro Surge. You mentioned, you know, stories in the media. It's not just in the media. If you talk to the businesses that have come to me and come to our department and hear their stories, it is not a fiction. And I am confident that you will hear from all the other testifiers today. I sat at Savory's Fresh Market with Representative Zhang and heard the stories. And they have to operate with, in some cases, their doors locked. Now, you want to run a business where you're opening the doors to all, to the community, and as many people who are paying customers as you can get. And in this case, they have to, you know, make sure that it's not a federal agent coming in to apprehend one of the workers. So that's no way to run a business. I am delighted that our overall economic performance has been strong, and I'm glad that you see those facts as well. But imagine if we were at X, and we could be at X plus one, if we hadn't harmed these immigrant businesses this way and all the other businesses too. Like, we should be aiming for as rapid of growth as we can. Clearly, we've had a negative impact on many businesses. It's great that we are diverse enough as an economy that it hasn't resulted in a Minnesota recession. But for the individuals whom this is impacting, it's a massive story, lots of tears shed. and I would love for us to be able to help them.
And Representative Schultz, if it's okay, maybe that maybe you're quick, because you raised a big question, and maybe it's something we can continue discussing as the further testifiers go on. I've got some thoughts and answers to it, too. But we'll go to Representative Greenman, and I think we'll then need to go to the next testifier. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's less of a question and more of a comment, because I think during the pandemic, what we saw was the biggest impact fell of all of this on local businesses, on folks who are working class and lower income. And so we saw continued tax revenues from the richest of the rich and the biggest corporations, which is, I think, what you're referencing, Representative Schultz. In the last 10 weeks, we're talking about the last 10 weeks, right? This started on December 1st, but when Customs and Border Patrol came and the violence and the targeting of folks in our community, citizen, non-citizen alike, businesses owned by everyday people. If you go out and you talk to people, and not just in Minneapolis or St. Paul, definitely in my community in Minneapolis, but in communities across the state, what you will hear from small businesses, from the local businesses, the hardware stores, the groceries, the local groceries, the local diners, is that not only is their worker base impacted, their customer base is impacted, people are not in the same position to both go out, because if you're not working or you're afraid because you're black or brown, it doesn't matter your status, you're being pulled over, you're not going out and soliciting businesses. And so I appreciate you citing our revenue. I think it'll be interesting to hear MMB, but baked into that is not the business closures. Baked into that is not the cost that our local governments have expended. Go talk to the local governments who have law enforcement, who now it's going to go into the property tax base because they've had to call out law enforcement to keep the peace and protect people from ICE and Customs and Border Patrol escalation. None of that is in the statistics that you are citing. And so we will see over the medium and over the short, medium and long term, as since we're talking about last 10 weeks, the loss of rent and the landlords who are going to have to cover that, the loss to local governments and the property taxpayers are going to have to cover that, the loss to our tax base long term from the businesses and the workers who are being hurt. And all of this, what not only was not asked for, is totally avoidable if the federal government hadn't turned their operations on the citizens and the residents of Minnesota. And that's the tragedy here. We couldn't have avoided COVID because that was a natural disaster. But this is a man-made disaster by the federal government that will hurt our economy and our people now and long time into the future.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I said that we're going to move on to another testifier, but my co-chair has a question.
Well, just a real quick question, Mr. Or Commissioner. Where will this money come from? I'm hearing around other committees there's a lot of requests for dollars for a lot of different things. We don't have any money. We have a looming deficit the last time I checked. Does the governor, again, I don't have any details on this loan program or this forgivable loan, and $10 million is going to cover 600 to 800 businesses total. It's not much of anything, but again, I just want to know, where's this money initially planning on coming from?
Commissioner.
Mr. Co-Chairs, thank you for the question, and I believe it is just a general fund appropriation recommendation.
And I maybe will note, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz is pointing out there is more money coming in as of late.
Well,
so
but
this
we have
is an ongoing conversation.
And to that, Mr. Chair, we have a budget that we have to live by. We've agreed to a budget. We did it last year. The budget is signed off on. We did our work. And again, there's things that do pop up. I'm not saying that they don't, but you know, this is going to be a conversation that we're going to have, I'm sure, for several discussions and meetings. But this is not just a simple man-made thing that happened. This was happening, and it could have happened because of other policies before all this. This is a culmination of a lot of years of how we got here. So we're Minnesotans, and we're going to try to figure this out. But we don't have the money laying around like we used to when we had $17 billion in the surplus. It's gone. And so I just want to make sure that we are realistic about where this is going to come from, because this is not a budget year. So appreciate that. I look forward to getting more information from Deed.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Yeah, and regarding the specific proposal, again, it'll be back before us formally. We'll have ongoing conversations. I want to kind of set the table today. Commissioner, thank you so much. And we'll invite the folks from actually Sarah Peterson coming up next.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being with us. Ms. Peterson, welcome to you. Thank you for being with us. I'll apologize in advance that we've got a lot of folks testifying. Of course, you're running a little bit late, but so glad to have you with us. Please, if you can identify yourself and proceed.
I'm Sarah Peterson. I'm an immigration attorney.
Oh, as your microphone is on, yes, people can hear me. Sounds like testing. Okay, good.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, better.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I'll lean in. Okay. Good morning, Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members. My name is Sarah Peterson, as I said. I'm an employment-based immigration lawyer, and for the past 20 years, I have represented Minnesota's healthcare systems and higher education in navigating complex federal immigration laws. I'm here today because rapidly changing immigration policies are directly affecting Minnesota's healthcare workforce and our higher education across our state. I was only given 5 minutes, so I'm going to do a really fast overview here, and I want to start with just looking at how our legal system has changed over the past year. So we've not had meaningful congressional immigration reform in the past 30 years, and in its void, immigration policy has increasingly been shaped through executive and agency orders. Since January 2025, the current administration has enacted more than 634 immigration policy changes, which is more than the entire first term of the Trump administration. Further, USCIS was created after 9/11. USCIS is Citizenship and Immigration Services, and it was created as a benefits-granting agency to process all legal immigration status applications. Yet over the past year, USCIS has shifted its mission away from adjudicating legitimately filed petitions and focusing rather on rooting out fraud that it believes exists, despite providing any public data to support this priority shift and a need to really change up the mechanisms we've used historically to get to the fraud. This, combined with staffing turnover, reassignments, and loss of institutional expertise, has led to substantial delays in the process of legal immigration petitions. So this morning, I want to focus on two big changes, one caused by Metro Surge and one caused by the changes I just described that impact Minnesota's healthcare workforce and our higher education institutions. So first, in January of 2025, after more than 30 years of our government designated churches, hospitals, and schools as safe spaces, spaces where ICE enforcement actions did not occur for the obvious reasons, this administration removed this longstanding guidance, which has had consequential ripple effects on our communities. In healthcare, hospitals are trying to maintain continuity of care in this environment of fear and uncertainty, and I've spent a lot of time advising healthcare organizations in terms of how to protect their staff and their teams and their patients. U.S.-trained international doctors are afraid to go to work, and patients are afraid to seek care. And this uncertainty negatively impacts our ability to ensure quality healthcare care across our state. In higher education, students are afraid to go to class. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I can tell you students are afraid to show up. Many are still attending via Zoom, and that negatively impacts quality of education for everybody involved. Second, another big change is this administration's new $100,000 payment for certain H-1B petitions. Yeah, $100,000 per person. And remember, H-1B visa is the primary visa for highly skilled professionals to work in the United States. It includes physicians, researchers, faculty, and more. Employers pay at minimum currently $5,000 to $6,000 in government filing fees per H-1B worker. This additional $100,000 fee is cost prohibitive. This new payment is coupled with USCIS's immigration benefits pause, which is for the 40 countries that are on the travel ban list. This administration has also dramatically increased vetting, which simply means USCIS is not processing legal paperwork. So what does this mean in practice for our Minnesota healthcare organizations? We know healthcare is the number one economic driver in Minnesota. We also know that there is a well-documented shortage of physicians across the country. And while there's not good statewide data, nationally, more than 25% of practicing physicians in our workforce right now are international medical graduates. These are U.S.-trained doctors who have gone through U.S. residency and fellowship again, despite having practiced in their own countries. And because of specific immigration programs that we have, they serve predominantly in rural and urban underserved communities across our state, and they remain in these communities longer than their counterparts. We're at a pivotal moment. We're starting on July 1st, which is the end of our medical training cycle. Healthcare centers who have gone through an arduous process to recruit and then sponsor these U.S.-trained doctors may not be able to employ them in desperately needed communities. This is going to result in delayed start dates, and in some instances will require these healthcare providers to pay the $100,000 payment, or worse, these doctors are just going to leave and not come back. For example, I currently represent a U.S.-trained cardiologist whose rural employer has had five open cardiology positions for years, And due to this benefits pause, we're not confident that he's going to be able to start on July 1st, which means patients in this rural community in our state will continue to experience long wait times for heart health care. So you can see the economic impact of losing even a fraction of the physicians that our policies have touched is catastrophic, and particularly for rural health care. And I'm hoping one of my co-panelists today will talk about the humanitarian programs and the cancellations of those programs, because it also impacts healthcare across the state. I don't have time to get into it. I'm going to finish with talking about the impact on higher education in Minnesota, which is equally significant. So we also know international students are the cornerstone of our economy. Over half of the STEM graduates across the country are international students. But due to early administration actions in 2025, targeting international students who are here legally, the Minnesota state is projected to lose 1.34 million, or, I'm sorry, let me say it again, 13.4 million in this 2025-2026 academic year due to declining enrollment. And these numbers are projected to rise as our uncertainty continues to define our immigration system. Prospective students are deciding not to pursue higher education in the United States at all, and they're going to our competitive countries, Canada, Australia, Western Europe, what have you. And I can tell you, as a parent of twins in college, I'm staring down increased tuition costs as a result. But beyond tuition revenue, international students are critical to our innovation pipeline. They support approximately 3,500 jobs in our state each year through their work and their funding. Many go on to work in healthcare, research, engineering, and technology. Many are my clients. When these students are not able to remain in Minnesota, we lose not only tuition dollars, but long-term economic growth, research capacity, and startup potential. So ultimately, immigration policy is workforce policy, it's economic policy. And right now, we need smart immigration policies that are reliable and predictable, developed through meaningful, fact-based, bipartisan debate like this that aligns with our workforce needs and protects access to healthcare and education in Minnesota and beyond. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in front of you, and I am happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Peterson. And members, part of the reason that I wanted to have Ms. Peterson speak with us is in particular that impact on healthcare, because we know there's a massive workforce shortage already. I remember talking with Chair Baker about that quite a bit last spring. And then knowing that such a significant percentage of our workforce are folks who are immigrants, and for our rural areas especially, just a massive, it's already a big gap. So we'll see if there are questions for you. I'm not sure that I'm seeing any. So thank you so much for your testimony, for being with us. I'll call up Allison Thorson, and can I have our Minneapolis Foundation folks be kind of on deck and ready to go. Is Allison Thorson with us? And oh, there you go. Okay, yeah. And once you get settled in, if you can identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Hi, my name is Allison. I use she, her pronouns. Good morning, Chair Pinto, or Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members. My name is Allison. I'm the Workforce Development Manager at Unidos Minnesota Education Fund, which is the sister organization of Unidos Minnesota. I run our apprenticeship readiness program, which provides an accessible on-ramp for low-wage workers to access green and union jobs in the construction trades.
I'm going to ask you to pull the microphone a little bit closer to your mouth, yeah, if you can. Or just, yeah, thanks.
Is that better?
Yeah, that is better,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. This program was recently developed from the experiences of low-wage workers of color who face disproportionate levels of exploitation and unsafe conditions at work, especially in construction. The program exposes workers to the union trades who have historically not had access, giving them tools to build family-sustaining careers and work more safely. We launched in late September 2025 and have trained 36 workers in 4 cohorts. To participate, every individual must have a Social Security number and have the legal right to work in the U.S. Funding for the program is highly competitive, and we continue to work with our state and local partners to meet our workforce goals. Yet, since the surge in federal activity in Minnesota, we've seen an 80% reduction in Latino workers signing up for the program. This complicates our efforts to train the workforce Minnesota desperately needs. In our January cohort, only 7% of participants came from communities targeted by ICE, while in our first 3 cohorts completed before the surge, the average was 62%. Our building is located in South Minneapolis, but our program serves residents across the state, including from Rochester and Rogers. Some of our participants have driven from over an hour away to attend classes. Because ICE was very active in the area, and out of fear for our participants and staff safety, we postponed our January program. Two graduates from our first cohort are from East Africa, and since they graduated, they have worked amazingly hard to overcome barriers and find union jobs. But since the start of the surge, they have barely left the house for fear of being racially profiled. One of them was an inventor in his home country and dreams of being a machinist, being financially stable, and owning a car. One of them worked as an electrical engineer and aims to join the electricians union, but says he struggles to continue his day-to-day life here. Minnesota workers deserve better than living in constant fear of profiling and unlawful arrest, and our state deserves access to critical training infrastructure to grow our labor force. The current ICE surge has proven highly damaging for individuals trying to build their skills and opportunities to support themselves and their families. Please help us support the Minnesota workers who have been targeted by this occupation so they can continue to build prosperity for their families in our state. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there questions from Ms. Thorson at all? And not seeing any, thank you so much for being with us. We'll invite Minneapolis Foundation folks to come up, and little boys, you'll be on deck, and so be ready to pop up once they're done. Welcome to you both. I think, R.T. Ryback, you're going to be going first, and so please identify yourself. Welcome to the committee, and proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair. As R.T. Ryback, CEO of the Minneapolis Foundation, I'm here with our Senior Vice President, Joanne Stately, and Kenneth Eban, who leads our advocacy work.
Okay.
Minneapolis.
One second. Do you have a microphone in front of you? Is on and all? Okay. Yeah, I don't know why I was having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Okay.
Working all right?
Yeah, I think it's okay.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate very much being here and appreciate the topic. The Minneapolis Foundation is a 110-year-old foundation. It was founded in Minneapolis, but it does significant work around the state. We do grant work in education and economic mobility, as this topic is, but we also represent people who want to be generous, who have a fund with us. Their dollars go throughout the state. We're currently working on a statewide program on environment that deals with clean water in Hackensack, energy efficiency in counties in southern Minnesota. And also, we were the partner with the state on the Main Street program that developed that bipartisan program and helped businesses throughout the state recover from the COVID issue.
And one thing, too, I'm just going to note, the presentation that's up, members, I think we had not gotten in advance, but we'll end up, we'll share it with you afterwards, just in case you're wondering.
Okay.
I know it's not up now, but I think, is it coming back up? We're kind of working on it.
Here we go.
Okay. In any case, whenever it does come up, just members, if you're confused, we don't have it right now, but we'll get it distributed. Please continue. Thanks. Sorry.
Thank you. When the ICE surge began, the Minneapolis Foundation moved very, very quickly to help deliver resources to people. We really focused a lot on humanitarian aid. We, in that case, provided a lot of assistance to small organizations that became part of delivering tens of thousands of meals around the state, and have increasingly moved into the issue of rental assistance and foreclosure prevention, which are two of the huge issues that are coming out of that. But I'm from the fourth generation of people in my family who've had a small business on a corner Main Street in the state, from New Prague to St. Paul to downtown Minneapolis to the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis. And I recognize that when big business gets a cold, small business gets pneumonia. And that's especially true for the hospitality industry, which is, I would call, a Robin Hood industry, one that is a place where someone can come into this state with a very low income, work two jobs, and be able to work their way up into leadership in an organization. So it's critically important. We've done several things, and Joanne will, in a second, talk about the Economic Recovery Fund. But what we did first off is to recognize we want to be a partner with the state. When the commissioner mentioned the statewide program to encourage shopping in small businesses, we're the main funder of that. And we also are funding other efforts throughout the state to encourage people to go back into spending money in small stores. We're not going to philanthropy or government fund this program away. However, we also are trying to raise funds for the hospitality industry through something called the Salt Cure Fund. And after Alex Pretty was shot, I got on the phone with some business leaders, leaders of large businesses, and really said we needed to get them much more aggressively in the game. And I'm happy to say in 48 hours, we raised $4 million our team led by Joanne got those dollars out, and they're immediately out on the street now working with these nonprofits that work with businesses, and we're getting those dollars out. We're partnering with Greater MSP to raise more dollars. We do not come here and say that the state government should solve this issue alone. But we would say that the incredibly significant economic impact on those at the bottom end of the spectrum who would otherwise be getting public assistance need assistance right now. So we're aggressively working both every channel we have with large businesses throughout the state and partners around the country to bring those dollars in. What we're looking to do is to do something similar to what we did after COVID, where our foundation played a role with the state in making sure we got those dollars directly to the small businesses quickly and with efficiency and effectiveness. And the person who did all that work to my right is Joanne Stately, Senior Vice President.
And thank you so much. And please identify yourself and proceed.
Chairman Pinto, Chairman Baker, my name is Joanne Stately. I am the Senior Vice President at the Minneapolis Foundation. And unlike RT, I can't say there's four generations that I represent. I am an enrolled member of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, and I'm from the White Earth Nation. So I'm Indigenous, and I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to work with a foundation that is looking at the general welfare of all the people in Minnesota. I have had the opportunity to be part of our response effort that related to COVID. This is not the type of work that we did traditionally at the Minneapolis Foundation. My role has been in supporting both small businesses and economic development across our communities for the last 16 years. This was something that we were not necessarily already prepared for, but we used our assets to leverage the opportunity and the timing to provide rapid response at that time. I think this is the role that community foundations and other funders can do, as we can be those first on the line of service and response. But without government coming in and assisting at a later date, it becomes much harder to do. Our experience in raising funds very rapidly as a result of COVID and after the murder of George Floyd relied on other contributions from our fund holders, other people that had, were charitable minded, and our business community and general individuals in the community that raised dollars very rapidly to help deploy support to those businesses that had been impacted specifically after the murder of George Floyd. Some of you may have remembered a fund that we did create at the Minneapolis Foundation was called Restore, Rebuild, Reimagine. That was a $14 million fund that was the result of businesses, again, stepping up and wanting to help with that repair of businesses that were damaged. That was the first step. We're kind of in that first step now. We're being responsive. This is an emergency response, but we know this is a 1 to 3 month opportunity that we're talking about and providing direct cash and assistance to these small businesses. And we are focusing on small businesses. After this, we're looking at what does that next level of response look like? There's going to be more capital that's going to be needed. We know this is a long haul. This isn't going to be done in a year. This could be a 3 to 5 year process. So we're looking at that long view and looking for support, again, from our philanthropic community and also for our government and how they're going to step in. Now, the role that we've played as the Minneapolis Foundation is that we have an infrastructure to help deploy funds very rapidly, but we don't do this. We're not the experts. We rely on our partners that have been doing this in our community. Nonprofits, well-capitalized nonprofits with the support from government funding and also from philanthropy. But capacity is always going to be an issue, and capacity is an issue for those nonprofits right now as well. When we've launched this new fund that's called our Economic Recovery Fund, as RT has mentioned, this was done within a week and a half when we actually announced, and it was last Wednesday when we announced the availability of these dollars. We would not be able to do this if we didn't already have those partners in place that are actually going to be making the decisions about those grants. We've been very targeted based on their feedback to say what the importance is. So this is a small response grant. The grants range from $2,500 up to $10,000. This is the first phase. Okay, $4 million is not enough, but it's enough to provide some of that gap to help these businesses meet their current cash needs, and it can be used for inventory. It can pay their rent. It is to help their businesses just stay on and hold on a little bit longer. We received over 1,000 applications within a week. We're expecting another 1,000 applications in the next week, and we will probably be closing this very soon. But hopefully then we'll have another phase to be able to offer to these businesses. We're very pleased this is a statewide program, and we've have representation throughout the state where businesses are applying. And if any of the representatives would like to kind of have an idea of where that, what that means in your communities, I do have a map, and I actually do have numbers if people are interested in doing this. I think what we're looking for is just, again, to let the committee know that we appreciate the role that we get to play, but we really need the government to be able to respond to this as well. The economic impact is huge.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just finish by saying this is an incredibly important piece of the response that we need to have. It is not the only tool in our toolbox, and it's not the only thing we're involved with. As I mentioned, we are aggressively going out to the general public and saying, we won't have PPP loans this time. We have a huge issue here. Go out, and if you love someone, take them out for Valentine's Day, but once a week for the next few months here. And more important than that, we're going to see over time there will be other tools needed. We're talking to the lending community about whether there's restructuring of loans. We're looking at a series of other issues. So as this works its way through the legislature, we'll be getting feedback in real time about what the needs are of small businesses and ideally partner with you on evolving the needs and the response.
Well, thank you so much. There was a slide that you had that showed just the costs that had been imposed. We weren't walking through the individuals. So you can just go back that, maybe have that up as we're going to questions. I at least want to be able to look at it a little bit more. But we'll go first to Representative Schultz. We got Representative Schultz, Frazier, and Greenman on the list. Representative Schultz. Ms. Kozlowski. I'm sorry, Ms. Redd. Kozlowski. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor Ryback. Do you believe that businesses who operate in Minnesota or Minneapolis in this instance, that they should be adhering to federal law as it relates to I-9 forms?
Mr. Chairs,
I absolutely believe that businesses should adhere to the law. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason that I bring that up is it is illegal under federal law to employ people who are here illegally. It is against the law.
Right.
Okay. So I wanted to start with that because that seems to be an instance of like we're supporting people who are employing people who are here illegally, and that's a challenge. I also wanted to ask, there was a lot of so your organization sent out a lot of money in response to Operation Metro Surge, and I wanted to find out, would your organization have supported the efforts of a syndicate of other nonprofits or NGOs that were directly impeding the work of law enforcement?
Okay, and just pause for a second, because Representative Schultz, you've had your question there had two different pieces, and I almost wonder, maybe we should just address the first section first on the sketch of what you just said, because the first question, you were talking about businesses that employing people who lack documentation, but my point at the very start of this hearing and from everything we've heard is that we're talking about businesses employing people with legal status, businesses employing U.S. citizens. So we're not sort of misunderstanding one another, that everything that we're hearing about is businesses employing folks with legal status. So I just to sort of first deal with that, I want to get to the second half of your question, but just to make sure that we're very clear that that's the impact that we're talking about is businesses with legal status. Mr. Ryback, do you want to just respond just briefly on that piece, and then let's get to the second half of Representative Schultz's question.
And Mr. Chair, I actually know a fair amount about law enforcement because I was mayor of a city for 12 years and have spent a lot of time understanding what is legal enforcement and what is not, and so I think there were some significant issues there. However, the main point, and I think you made it, Mr. Chair, is the idea that this is not about a person's legal or illegal status. This is about the fact that this affected people across the entire spectrum. I'll give you an anecdote, Mr. Chair and Representative. My wife and I have a son-in-law who's from Brazil, and we befriended a waitress, and we're talking to her about that and about how difficult it'll be for him to move to this country. And she said, well, my son's father is from Mexico, and I worry about him in my small town. That was at the Black and White Cafe in Little Falls. And in that cafe, that woman and us from the city and from the small town recognized that legal status doesn't necessarily mean safety. Right. And certainly in this era, and what we saw and in chilling ways, people across the spectrum being able to go out, being unable to go out of their house, not because of their status, but because what the practice was of ICE was not targeted, and it was going after people across a broad spectrum, including possibly that kid in Little Falls. I don't know what happened to them, but I know what would happen to them in the neighborhoods I was in, and they could very well be separated from their family. And, Mr. Chair, what's critical about that is that rippled throughout the entire economy of the entire state. In Minneapolis, eventually, ICE became much less effective because the response was so strong. They began to move out into other parts of the state. And as that has continued to happen, and believe me, it's continuing to happen, as that continues to happen, the person in Wilmer who is absolutely legally here is in jeopardy. Even if they aren't literally in jeopardy, the chill effect that that has on both customers and workers has had an extraordinary economic impact on especially those at the lowest end of the economic spectrum, as well as the entrepreneurs who own businesses.
And then to the second half of Representative Schultz's question, I'll try to restrain my own comments on it, but just he referenced a possible connection with, I think you'd use the term syndicate of nonprofits. Anything that you want to talk about that in terms of the response to ICE actions?
Mr. Chair, we work with nonprofits across the state of Minnesota, and we're extremely proud of the fact that over the 110 years we've been here, a large part of our expertise is determining the validity and the effectiveness of nonprofits. So we're very proud of that work.
Okay. I'm going to want to move on. Representative Schultz, something quick, though?
Yeah, I'll make just a quick comment. Yeah. For the record, members, I actually probably spent more time in the month of January in Minneapolis trying to help support businesses. My wife and I did a staycation in Minneapolis on the weekend of ICE out. We sought to support the small businesses. I've sat in this room many a time and told you how my family runs a Main Street small business. It's disheartening to me that our small employers across the state are encountering a challenge. And I sought to support them. For that weekend, I visited the Carmel Mall for the first time in the month of January. Enjoyed incredible food, and our side of the aisle wants our economy to thrive. And for us, that means that we need to adhere to and enforce the law. That's what that means. And we need to ensure that we're having our state policy match up with the labor laws on the federal level, and to ensure enforcement so that Minnesota workers and small businesses can thrive. And I want to ensure that public money is never being spent to work against law enforcement. And I'll just leave it at that and say that I care deeply about the economy in the Twin Cities.
Thank you, Rem Schultz, and very much agree about public money supporting enforcement of our laws. Representative Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Representative Schultz, I was asking my good friend here if you invited him over when you went to Harvard Mall. he said no. And thank you for visiting, though. But what I can tell you, what you experienced when you went there is not the real experience of that mall, because I went there during this occupation, and there was hardly anybody there. Those halls are usually full, plumb full, hard to move around in, and I guarantee you didn't experience that. But I do appreciate you going out. Any amount of business is helpful. To Mayor Ryback, you know, thank you for your leadership and what you're doing at the foundation for moving so quickly. I've been watching you online, and I really appreciate how you're lifting up the state as a whole, and I know people around the country appreciate it as well and are following. So thank you for doing that. And to the folks with you, thank you for all the work that you're doing to try to help our businesses in this time of great need. It is a crisis. It is an emergency. And what I do know and understand about the way the systems work here, there's a lag on the unemployment. So we will see that, Representative Schultz. There's a lag on that. And the very revenue that we're going to need as we're projecting this budget in the outcoming years, we're going to be missing a big chunk of that because of what's happening with these employers and the workers that are there. So we should all be paying attention and mindful of that and looking for ways to make sure we can help those folks. I'm glad that you pointed out the number of applicants that applied right away, because I think this is counter to, we've got people asking us not to believe our eyes, not to believe what we're hearing, not to believe the experiences that our neighbors are having. So I'm glad you're pointing those things out and confirming what our agency also is saying as well. I love we have experts in the room and people on the ground to do that. I just love it. The one question that I do have is, with the resources going in and we're looking to do more, what type of safeguards do you have in place to make sure those resources are getting to where they need to be?
So again, Ms. Taylor. Apologize.
No problem. Please.
And Representative Fraser. We work with our intermediaries that are the expertise in this level of involvement and working, particularly with small businesses. When you're asking what are those kind of areas to look to the I think you're talking about fraud, perhaps, to prevent against fraud, particularly. I mean, we do check and that the businesses are registered with the state of Minnesota. We do ask applicants to provide at least 1 year or perhaps 2 years of their tax returns so that we can look at their business revenues. We ask them to keep their records in case they are audited or we are audited, that is going to be available. And it's right sized. I mean, we're looking at what's the right size type of grant to be able to, recommend and, to supply to that organization. Now, with this rapid response, it's not as high of that level of detail. And I do want to say, I hope if you register with the state of Minnesota that there are safeguards in that as well. If you become a business, there are things to say that, yes, you've met that, whatever that level of responsibility is to be registered. But that's where we start. That's kind of our baseline. And I think our partners are very cleanly aware that they're working with both public dollars and private dollars. And we have fund holders that we're responsible to let them know how their dollars are being used as well. And sure. That gets to your question. But I also want to say we have 30 applications from your district.
Chair Fraser, back. Okay. Oh, Chair Fraser, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor Ryberg, did you want to add anything to that?
I would just say, Mr. Chair, we've more than $150 million has flown through the foundation this year, and that's more than $100 million each year. And our effectiveness is proven by that number and the fact that we've been effective throughout that.
Back to you, Chair Fraser, and I do want to make sure we get to those other testifiers. But Chair Fraser,
thank you for laying that out, the processes and those safeguards. And it was to get to this conversation that we've been having around fraud. I think it's important the resources get to where they need to get to. And in this crisis, we need them to get to where they need to get to. And thank you for whatever you've been able to do for businesses in my district. I can tell you, again, being on the ground, visiting those business owners, driving by them every single day and seeing the lack of traffic that is normally there, we know people are hurting. And we know some of those businesses are not going to be there when we come out of this. So thank you for everything that you're doing now. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Representative Kozlowski.
I just want to say thank you. got mine.
But yeah, like, everywhere I go, I'm like, listen, you got your title ID, you got your password on you. This isn't about status or citizenship, and if we're talking about the law, then you need to not break the most supreme law of the land, which is violating treaties.
No one is illegal on stolen land. And so I want to bring this back to people like Jose in my district who just driving along and going to his way of work, young kid, and he was stopped. And they admitted, ICE and HSI admitted at the court hearing that they had nothing. They didn't even show up to the hearing. They accused him of trafficking. Every single charge was dropped. It didn't matter. The damage was done. He, even though he has special juvenile protected status, legal protected status, that business shuttered and closed down for weeks. And thanks to the dollars that you've gotten out there, that business is going to have a little line of hope. But these are people, every single day I get phone calls from constituents. Hey, I'm trying to get home from college back to Duluth. How can I get across the state? Hey, we're fleeing the cities. We need to come to a domestic violence shelter. Help. Can you help? Hey, I need to take my garbage out. I need to move my car. And now I got a ticket that I'm too scared to go to the courthouse. Can you help? Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm a Main Street business. I'm an Asian Latino store. Can you help? We're trying to get groceries out to community. We can't get to the cities or we can't get to the reservation. Can you help? My child care workers in Duluth, of all of the ones that were audited, who do you think got audited? The one black provider. Our healthcare workers, our students. And I'll say that at a time where we are causing, this federal government is causing generational impacts, to hear colleagues on the other side continue to racially gaslight and say that this is not the reality, when Minnesotans are hearing you really loud and clear that you're saying you're on your own, and in fact we're going to cheer this on, and I'm grateful for you for stepping up and doing this, and the state needs to step up, prosecute these crimes, and come to the shielding of our small businesses, to renters, to our communities from ongoing further harm.
Representative Kozlowski, thank you. Representative Hussein.
Good morning, and thank you for being here, Minneapolis Foundation, and what you have done is stunning. I mean, a lot of businesses are really struggling when it comes to, in especially in my district and throughout the state of Minnesota. Metro Search did not help. They created chaos. They were targeting people that looks like me, exactly. And we could say this was a racial profiling. A lot of businesses are hurt. A lot of people that used to work in the businesses, whether it's you have a legal status or work permit, not illegals, all those people that are employee are here for legally, and they have a work permit, or either they're citizens or they are in the transition to get a citizen, but could not show up to work. Was racial profiling, detain them, arrest them. There was a few citizens in my district who's born here in Minnesota, has been locked up, ICE, and send them to all the way to Sherman County. When her dad called in my office, it's like, I can't find my daughter for 2 days. I don't know where to call. So my office has reached out to detainees, and they told me that this has been transferred over to Sherman County, from Ramsey County all the way to Sherman County. A kid stopped born here in the state of Minnesota, has nothing to do. She was just getting her grocery and walking to her apartment. And ICE, what they was doing is they overpopulating locations that BIPOC community that I live in, minority people, businesses, they were targeting individuals, not searching for criminals, not searching for those, and they're not making our states better. They make one of the worst. This is going to be devastated, and it's going to hurt a lot of businesses. Every business owners, every individuals that came to American Dream. Why immigrant came here in America? To make it better. We all immigrant. Either we came different timing, different generations, either we are the third generation, unless you are indigenous land, a lot of businesses will never come back unless we do something to support small businesses. That's how we get the taxpayers back. That's how is our economy is booming in our state. If we don't take care of those, you know, workers and people that really need it, we're going to be in very, very deficit forever. So let's help with those people that are doing a good job. And a lot of people are still reaching out to my office and still locked up in their house, worried, not sending their kids to school, not getting the grocery out, not going to work, because they are really, really worried because whether they what we have seen in the state of Minnesota, and I don't think so it happened anywhere else. But what we have done, the people of Minnesota, when COVID happened, we came together. We delivered groceries each other's. We take care of medication each other's. This is the time that we need to help for those small businesses if we really care about it. This committee should put sights and difference away. This is a bipartisan issue for our state. I beg you, and I'm asking you, please, let's help those businesses throughout the state, not in metro area. A lot of businesses are hurt throughout your districts. Chair Baker, I know you have a lot of East African businesses in your district. They're reaching out to my office and they're crying for help. Duluth, St. Cloud, throughout the state. So let's come up with something that we could do to help for those businesses and hold that accountable. Make sure that dollar amount gets to the people that really deserve so they can bounce back and help and create our economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hussein, and thank you to the folks from the Minneapolis Foundation. We really appreciate you being here. Thank you. I'm going to call up Lil Blois, and if Emery and John can come up as well, sit up at the testifier table. And as you get settled in, I guess, Lil Blois, if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. And yeah, thank you.
Lil Blois, I am the Director of Operations for the Latino Economic Development Center. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me the time to testify today. As I stated before, I am Lil Blois, and I am the Director of Operations for the Latino Economic Development Center, also known as LEDC. LEDC is unique because we help Latino entrepreneurs launch and grow small businesses through business classes. We do workshops, and we provide one-on-one technical assistance on different topics related to business entrepreneurship to help them be successful and strive in their business. We also provide loans as a community development financial institution, or CDFI. Our clients are mainly from the Twin Cities, but we've expanded to outstate Minnesota as well. Today, I want to talk to you about how we recently shifted to creating funding and dispersing emergency grants to Latino immigrant businesses in crisis because of ongoing ICE and CBP activity. While many requests are coming from metro area businesses, we are seeing a significant need from those located in outstate Minnesota. Our organization recently reviewed 385 grant applications. We've gotten over 500 now, but we've gotten to review 385 submitted by small businesses across Minnesota in response to ICE-related enforcement activity. The data provides a clear, fact-based picture of economic disruption affecting communities across the state. Of the 385 businesses that applied, 25 are located in greater Minnesota, representing 136 employees and nearly $274,000 in requested assistance. While the majority of applications came from the Twin Cities, the proportional impact in rural and regional communities is significant, because these businesses are often economic anchors in smaller local economies. Statewide, these 385 businesses employ 2,268 workers and requested $4.49 million in assistance. More than 65% reported revenue losses greater than 50%. An additional 19% reported losses between 26 and 50%. The operational impacts are equally concerning. Only 26 businesses reported operating normally. 137 temporarily closed due to ICE activity. 218 are operating with limitations. In greater Minnesota, where there are fewer alternative employers and less commercial density, temporary closures and reduced operations ripple quickly through entire communities. Restaurants and food businesses were especially affected. 162 establishments employing over 1,300 workers. Retail, personal services, childcare, and health businesses were also impacted. Importantly, 333 of these businesses operate in rented space, meaning revenue loss immediately jeopardizes lease stability and commercial occupancy rates in local corridors. Cash reserves are extremely limited. Nearly half of the applicants reported having no cash reserves and personal finances already under strain. Another third relied entirely on regular business income to cover monthly expenses. This is not a partisan statement. This is an economic one. These are small employers, 342 of them Latino-owned, supporting more than 2,000 Minnesota workers. In greater Minnesota especially, when even a handful of businesses close or reduce operations, the effects extend to landlords, suppliers, employees, schools, and municipal tax bases. We believe it is critical that policymakers understand these impacts as part of any broader discussion. Thank you for taking the time to hear about this issue today, and I'm happy to hear any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. I think we'll move to Emery John, since it's also in sort of Northfield, additional perspective, and then we can maybe see if there are questions for either. You can stay up there, feel free to, and then, yeah, if you can come on up. Oh, yeah, either. Yeah, you can sit in any of the chairs, should work. Yeah, all good. And as you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Baker, co-chairs, I suppose. My name is Emery John. I'm here from Northfield, Minnesota, a town of 20,000 people, halfway to Rochester. We're known for having a decent, high quality of life, a really low unemployment rate, and two colleges. But the low unemployment rate means that businesses really struggle to hire people at all levels, entry level, senior management. We don't have the workforce to support the amount of economic growth we would like to see in our downtown and otherwise. I come here with a series of stories from our Main Street district. All of these come from within 8 blocks of each other. I'm going to look at my notes now because I started hot.
Yeah, I know. All good. All good.
Northfield has a 15% of our 20,000 person population is Hispanic, most of whom immigrated or are parts of families that immigrated 40 years ago from Maltrata, Veracruz, Mexico. They're overwhelmingly documented. They're over-indexed economically. They work 2 jobs. They start businesses. They stay in the local community. And as people have said, people who lack status, people who are sheltering in place do not necessarily lack status at all. They're staying home due to rational fear. We've seen cars broken into, rammed off the road, windows broken in front of kids in Northfield, in a rural county. Fear is bad for business. Fear is not good for an economy, not good for main streets, where you want people walking around, enjoying the day, 50-degree Saturday. One tactic used across Northfield, across Minnesota, has been these I-9 audits. With or without subpoenas, officers come to a business and ask a manager for the I-9s of their employees. And even if the manager, if there's no subpoena, may not comply right away, it just creates fear, right? It scares customers. It scares employees. People don't want to go there that day, that week. A young Latina American-born barista realized one morning a car was following her. This was about five blocks from City Hall. She learned through a local group chat that that car was linked to other ICE actions, and the officers approached her. She learned that they weren't after her. They were there to follow her home after her shift to get to her parents. Missing shifts became a rational response to an unimaginable risk. One Saturday evening dinner rush at a downtown restaurant, ICE arrived and arrested the head chef mid-shift. They had to close for the remainder of the evening. They were already short-staffed, and the busboys, who were scared to come in already, had their worst fears realized as their boss was carted out in handcuffs. One business owner managed to stay open, even though his customer base is shriveled, with the work of his wife and his son. And they're just tired, right? There are three people running a shop that needs 10, and half of their staff hasn't been able to come in. When I visited him for the second time, we sat in the front room with windows, and he craned his neck to watch every passing car because ICE had been circling his restaurant all day. His son was on a ladder installing security cameras. We got in through a locked door and a newly installed doorbell. Yeah. These people are tired, and they're trying their best to keep anchor businesses open. These are not just immigrant-owned businesses. These are businesses across our downtown. And there's been talk about funding pipelines today, so I'm the program associate responsible for Canva. I'm making the QR codes. I hand these out to businesses. This is what the grant looks like to a business. We talk with them about that application. We help them figure out their profit loss sheet, to call their accountant, to figure out how to apply for this funding. The money's almost gone that the LEDC has accessible to Northfield for greater Minnesota. Our local government is looking to dip into reserves to support emergency rental support and small business support, but it's a really dire time for our Main Street, for our small business community, and small businesses will close in 2 to 3 months. It might not be now, because you can only handle so many $10,000 legal fees before your reserves are gone. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you for your work and for sharing your experiences. Are there questions for either of these testifiers at this point, members? And not seeing any, thank you so much to both of you for being here, making the drive. And we'll have both of our long-term care folks come up if you can, please. And I believe you're presenting together to a certain extent. In the long-term care sector, I know of great interest to many of our members, and a massive workforce shortage separate from any of this. And then now you're going to share with us the impact of federal immigration activity in their sector. So whoever of you is going to go first, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Pinto, Chair Baker. My name is Nicole Mattson with Care Providers of Minnesota, and I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. The Long-Term Care Imperative is composed of two associations, Care Providers of Minnesota and Leading Age Minnesota, and together we represent over 2,000 long-term care employers throughout the state. As Chair Pinto mentioned, the senior care sector is facing persistent and severe workforce challenges. Today we have more than 12,500 open positions statewide, primarily in direct caregiving, but also in critical nursing and licensed roles. Our staffing situations are tenuous at best. Facilities are operating with little margin for disruption. Every single team member matters to ensure that residents receive safe, timely, and compassionate care. Immigrants and refugees are a vital part of that workforce. In Minnesota, approximately 30% of long-term care employees are foreign-born. They are the nursing assistants, nurses, culinary staff, environmental service workers, and senior leaders. They care for our parents and our grandparents every day. And because of this, our sector is likely to experience a disproportionate impact from the recent heightened federal immigration enforcement activity. We are hearing directly from our members about both immediate and ripple effects. Staff have reported being followed, questioned, or asked to provide identification outside of their workplaces. Others are expressing fear about leaving their homes at all, even when they are legally authorized to work. When employees are afraid to drive to work, to take public transportation, or to attend required trainings, that creates real-time staffing instability in facilities that already have no slack in their system. There are also significant indirect impacts. The broader climate of fear and uncertainty is increasing anxiety amongst staff and their families, and supervisors are spending more time addressing concerns, reassuring employees, and managing schedule disruptions. Providers are leaning into contingency staffing plans, particularly as they're also facing challenges secondary to increased paid family leave obligations. They're reviewing agency contracts, cross-training employees, adjusting assignments, and preparing for abrupt staffing challenges. Not tied to illness, but to fear. These are not hypothetical exercises. They are active conversations that are happening in management meetings today. Our workforce reality is fragile, so any additional external pressure is going to be felt, and it's getting harder and harder for us to absorb. We are also concerned about the longer-term implications for our workforce pipeline. Minnesota has invested intentionally in building pathways for new Americans into caregiving careers through adult basic education, English language learning, nursing assistant trainings, and employer partnerships. However, we are already hearing anecdotally that attendance has declined in some of those in-person nursing assistant programs as individuals choose to protect their safety rather than attend classes. And if that trend continues, it will further strain an already limited pipeline of caregivers and deepen our workforce shortages across the state. Long-term care operates 24/7 under strict staffing requirements. And when staffing fluctuates abruptly, the impact is immediate for both residents and the remaining staff. We are not here to debate federal policy, but to share what we are seeing on the ground. Additional external pressures on an already stretched workforce threatens care stability. These impacts are felt today and will likely reverberate into the future, and we urge the committee to recognize the connection between workforce policy, immigration enforcement, and access to care, and to ensure that lawfully authorized workers feel safe coming to work. Training pipelines remain strong, and employers have the clarity and support needed to maintain consistent care for Minnesota's older adults. And I will turn it over to my colleague, Aaron Huppert, who has additional remarks.
Ms. Huppert, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. To pick off where my colleague left off, my name is Aaron Huppert, and I am also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. At Leading Age Minnesota, which is the association that I work for, our staff are providing routine daily technical assistance and support to our members. That includes guidance for employers regarding their legal obligations, how to support their workers, and how to access community resources. Collectively, these immigration enforcement tools have been viewed about 1,200 times since the beginning of December, which is almost twice as many views as any other resource we have on our member website page. I think that really underscores the sense of urgency and demand across the state from our members. Beyond Operation Metro Surge, immigration policy changes have also resulted in unexpected workforce loss and hardship, as my colleague indicated. Minnesota is home to an estimated 6,000 temporary protected status holders. Many of those individuals are authorized to work and embedded in long-term care roles. So we have seen long-term care employers in both metro and rural communities lose staff due to changes in TPS status and then pauses or disruptions in visa processing. To put it pretty simply, our provider members are once again being asked to do a lot more, to be there for residents who can't switch to distance learning or limit their hours to weekend service. And that means that covering mandatory breaks is harder, providing for absences, earn safe and sick, or temporary staff, all things that our employers want to do, adds costs that show up in state budgets and in consumers' pockets. And I would be remiss if I didn't emphasize that that expectation to do more is coming at a time when Minnesota nursing homes and disability providers are being expected to do that with less now that they have a cap on their rates, which is effectively a cut in 2026. And those rates are intended to support workers and operations. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thanks so much to both of you for being here. See if there's any quick questions folks have. We very much appreciate you sharing your perspective on this. Thanks for being here. I'm going to ask Jake Schweitzer then to make your way on up. As he does, I just want to, and I should have done this earlier, members and members of the public as well, some of the materials in your packets. We have several articles, one building on the comments from Sarah Peterson about impact of federal immigration action on our healthcare workforce, on the real estate industry, on Minneapolis in particular, but we know, again, this is statewide. A report from the Cato Institute, contrary to some of the comments made, talking about the massive surpluses, budget surpluses that result from immigrants in our society, including noting that the federal deficit would be federal debt would be twice as large if it were not for immigrants. So far from being a drain on our public coffers, we make money from having immigrants in our society. And then a report from Minneapolis, impact on that city. And then finally, the report from North Star Action, Policy Action, which we'll have just a minute or two to hear from Jake Schweitzer about. But please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members of the committee. My name is Jake Schweitzer. I'm the Executive Director of North Star Policy Action. We are a think tank that promotes data-driven solutions to help working Minnesotans thrive. It doesn't take a PhD in economics to know that huge numbers of Minnesotans staying home or otherwise altering their lives out of fear of their own government will hurt the economy. Anecdotal evidence paints a stark picture, with businesses facing unplanned closures and losing staff and customer foot traffic. It's important to understand how vital immigrants are to Minnesota's economy. In the Twin Cities, immigrants account for roughly 1 in 7 entrepreneurs, bringing in $600 million in business income annually. Taken together, immigrant workers and business owners generate $41 billion in economic output in Minnesota each year. If we assume even a modest 10% decline in economic output among just immigrants in the state, it would suggest a weekly reduction of nearly $80 million for the state's economy. Co-Chair Pinto referenced the report in your packet. I'm going to discuss some new data that we weren't able to include, but you can find on our website, and I'd be happy to share with folks. We were working on it through the night last night. So at North Star Policy Action, we've tried to provide more concrete numbers to back up the voluminous anecdotal evidence of economic harm. Unfortunately, it's still early, and many of the best data sources aren't available yet, but we still partnered with Aaron Sojourner, the senior economist and deputy director of research at the Upjohn Institute, to make the best early assessment that we could given the limited data available. We combined data from Opportunity Insights Economic Tracker with data from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis to analyze how consumer spending changed in January as compared with other parts of the country that were not under attack by their federal government. We estimate consumer spending declined by 2.9% in Minnesota, representing a loss of $626 million in January alone. Reductions in spending on food and accommodation were even larger, dropping by an estimated 3.8% statewide and 4.1% in Hennepin County. Now, we readily admit that these estimates are noisy and that the data we're relying on is thin and provisional. We look forward to updating this analysis as more data becomes available. But I am confident to testify before you today that Minnesota's economy has suffered greatly as a result of the federal occupation, and that that suffering has not ended yet. Even though Tom Homan declared an end to Operation Metro Surge last week, we're still seeing examples of violent immigration enforcement. Minnesotans who've stayed home are faced with the impossible choice of deciding when the danger is over, and they likely won't all make that decision immediately or at the same time. Immigrants make up 1 in 12 residents, but nearly 1 in 9 workers statewide, contributing disproportionately to healthcare, childcare, construction, food production, manufacturing, and service industries. Economic harms like we've seen aren't a one-time contained event. They take time to ripple through an economy. When a worker misses a paycheck, they have less money to spend on things like rent, groceries, or other goods for their families. This hurts the grocery store that they otherwise would have shopped at. And the grocery store may have to cut back hours from their employees, who are now faced with the same decisions. If a childcare teacher misses work and can't care for an infant, that infant's parent can't go to work. That effect ripples out. If production lines slow down at a food processing plant, that company is going to buy less from Minnesota's farmers. That effect ripples out. It shouldn't be news that Minnesota has a severe housing shortage. As the Star Tribune article in your materials shows, the housing market is seeing declines that are directly attributable to federal actions. When less housing gets built, housing gets more expensive for Minnesotans. The Economic Policy Institute estimated that President Trump's stated deportation goals could cost Minnesota 7,000 jobs in the direct care sector, or 12% of the total direct care workforce. This will drive up costs for any Minnesotan who needs the services of direct care staff in their life, which is to say almost every Minnesotan. Research on the impact of deportations in direct care, childcare, and construction consistently show that these jobs are not backfilled by U.S.-born workers. They're simply lost to the economy. The human impact of this occupation has been tragic and terrifying. The direct economic harm that we've already seen has been devastating. Without government action to repair the harm caused by government actions, that economic harm will snowball and become enormous. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much, Chair Baker. I was going to go to you before this hearing closes, but I wasn't sure. Yes, my friend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. I just want a more general closing. If anybody had questions though for Jake, let's do that.
Yeah, good. We have got a couple things. So, Representative Schultz.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mr. Schweitzer?
That's right.
What would be your suggestion? So these are federal immigration enforcement actions. What role do you think the state has in response to this? And could you share your perspective as to what the role of a state taxpayer should be in response to this?
Mr. Schweitzer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. It would certainly be preferable for the federal government to respond to the harms that they've caused. The federal government can deficit spend. States cannot. It's much easier for them to respond to this, an emergency of this scale that they caused. Our response to the pandemic was much easier because the federal government stepped up and provided funds. If they do that in this case, that would be great. I'm not confident that they will, given that they caused the problem. And so we're left with the answer of what's to be done. I don't think that this state government can afford to say, well, the feds aren't going to do it, and we aren't either. That's accepting greater economic harm that will snowball, that will get worse, that will hurt each and every one of your communities. I don't think that's an answer that you can make, but that's your decision.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say, you know, I represent one of the poorest counties in the state, Kennebec County, consistently in the top five poorest counties in the state. And frankly, for the folks who are living in Ogilvie, Minnesota, I would hate to hear that their dollars would be going to Minneapolis in response to the enforcement of federal laws.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. And a reminder that Minneapolis, in particular, contributes far more to the state treasury than it takes back. So actually, we want to make sure that we keep those funds flowing. Any other questions at all? And if not, so I know Representative Greenman, you had something. And I'll certainly go to Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just feel thank you for being here. Thank you for all of our testifiers. Thank you for the folks who shared the stories of the people in our community who. Many can't be here because they are afraid to come and be in public. And I just wanted to correct the record on a few things. And I'm glad you started with, I think we have heard over and over again this assumption about all this is happening just because of the enforcement federal laws. We have a bunch of court orders that have actually said what is happening on our streets is a violation of federal law and a violation of the Constitution. What I heard, Ms. John, you say is fear is bad for business. It's bad for Main Street. And unfortunately, what this president and this administration has promised, fear is the point. A day of reckoning and retribution is what the president of the United States said when they sent in CBP, ICE. We saw the Bureau of Prisons. We saw HSI agents. And I think it is important that we acknowledge that because we are hearing testimony and we're hearing folks talk about the impact, but it is targeting citizens, it is targeting folks with legal status, it is targeting folks who lost their legal status overnight, refugees who in this country have been following all the rules we've set out and now are sitting in detention camps in Texas. They are targeting Minnesotans with whistles and cameras. That is not about enforcement of immigration law. It is, in fact, a violation of the Constitution and the United States and U.S. and state law. The other thing I want to correct the record on is this idea that somehow immigration and immigrants are not good for our economy. We heard all this testimony. But to re-up what Chair Pinto said, the Cato Institute, which is not a tool of the left, but actually the right, said that immigrants put in $10.6 trillion more in taxes than in spending. So, Representative Schultz, if you are worried about about a community that is draining our resources of our public coffers and our resources, it is the billionaires and the greedy corporations where you should be looking, not immigrants who are putting in way more than the government, than they are taking from the government. So I just will end with, I think that it's clear that this is so much bigger than the idea that somehow this is about ICE, and we all know that. As my colleague, Representative Frazier and Representative Kozlowski said, Minnesotans are believing their eyes. It'd be nice if the folks across the aisle would join us and talk about what we can do to protect Minnesota and Minnesotans as the public believes their eyes and knows that we have an out-of-control federal government. Thank you.
Chair Baker, to you.
Well, so much for settling it down a little bit, I guess. I think that our side, Representative Greenman, is very aware of the impact of our complete workforce. Our immigrant community is important to this. I didn't hear anything that contradicted that today. And I think that what I appreciated about today's meeting was the openness about small business and how hard it is in any situation. And, yeah, especially when you have this surge happening right now that we didn't sort of plan for, but again, because of policies, I'm not surprised we're here. I'm sorry. Policies that came from this committee over the years that make it harder for businesses, period. Small, medium, and large in Minnesota. You all know it. We all know it. We all hear it. But we're hearing from Minneapolis businesses right now because, again, yeah, there's been some traumatic events that have been happening. But remember, Minneapolis already has a 43% higher minimum wage than anywhere else in the state of Minnesota. They have higher franchise fees. They are pricing themselves out of the market to have a small business work, not just survive, but thrive. I want Representative Hussein's businesses to thrive, not just hang in there in a good day, in a good week, in a good month. I want them all to thrive. And Mayor Rabach, I want to follow up with the foundation because I want to know what we're doing in Minneapolis to make small businesses thrive in the environment where I'm hearing overwhelmingly my hospitality friends, they can't do it anymore in Minneapolis. And if we don't get real and talk about the real expenses, we heard today from different folks about paid family, ESST, break laws. We are part of this. We own it. Let's admit it, we own it, but we can help them. I'm wondering today if the Department of Revenue is actually thinking, should we give forbearance on sales tax payments to every small business right now that has to actually tomorrow has to pay their sales tax? And if they were affected by this, has the commissioner reached out to say, look, you don't have to pay it yet. We'll give you 90 days to pay your sales tax to keep some money in the bank to help pay your electric bill or your rent bill or to pay your labor. Right now, we could do things. The state can do things right now to help. We're throwing ideas around. We're in session. I'm ready to dive in and talk about this. But what we cannot do is work in this some sort of a vacuum that thinks that because things are all chaotic and that we didn't have part to say about that, how do we fix the chaos in the future? We don't just throw money at this today, but we got to get serious about giving businesses a chance around the state of Minnesota and get serious about what we have done to make it harder for them. And I look forward to this year, Mr. Chair. I look forward to having good conversations and honest conversations. But we are here, and this event that has taken place in our state is a moment we need to grab it, learn from it, and be better because of it, and have our small businesses just thank you. Because I tell you, my small business that owns runs a small Mexican restaurant back at home, he doesn't want $1,000 or $1,500. He wants to have the option to not have paid family for his business. That's what he wants. Now, maybe that's not everybody, but they should have those choices. But again, he's doing this out of his investment and everything else. We need a lot more to talk about here, and I appreciate the conversation today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I'll just note, I'm heartened by the recognition that action is needed, and I guess I'm going to choose to hear what you're saying, that action is needed because of the last couple months and not just broader as well. I want to remind us, this is not just Minneapolis. We heard from Northfield. We heard about Little Falls. I was in Lake City a few weeks ago at a Mexican restaurant closed there, and I can imagine rippling out from all throughout our state recognizing that, and it has very, very little to do with undocumented immigrants, what's happened. Very, do do not allow ourselves to be fooled. The last couple months has very little to do with undocumented immigrants. We're talking about folks with legal status and citizens. Yesterday, we heard about a community that needs support, and we extended that bipartisan support. We need to recognize there are communities throughout our state that are desperate for support because of the actions of our own federal government. Very little to do with undocumented immigrants and massive violations of rights and of laws. We have got to take care of ourselves and take care of our state. That's what we're talking about. And I know that'll be an ongoing conversation this whole session. Thank you so much to all. Chair, we usually give each other a chance. Is there any preview you want to make about next week at all?
Just real quick to members, I believe we have an overview with Deed with paid family medical leave, just to kind of get a sense of kind of where are we at with the first 40, 45 days or so. We've brought in some questions, so looking forward to just talking more about how is it rolling out. And so we'll just do that on Tuesday, 8:15.
And apologies for going a little bit long. Thank you all. With that, the meeting is adjourned.